why your liberty is in danger at the state level. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you again this week in the studio. And it's good to be with the folks out there in WLRY land. Today it looks like we're basically going to talk about why tyranny has no party boundaries, and it's not all concentrated at the federal level.
No. As we talked about last week, and we called people to get involved by making some phone calls, we're going to continue on because this past Monday, the Ohio Controlling Board met to consider the request made by the Kasich administration to, well, basically go around, do an end run around the Ohio General Assembly, the legislators who are supposed to make the laws, to basically put us into Obamacare by going after and accepting somewhere in the neighborhood of about $2.5 billion of more money from the feds to expand Ohio's Medicaid program. Now, this is an issue that's been going on all year, Charles, because the governor has been pushing for Medicaid expansion even from before his State of the State address in early February, which I wouldn't say privileged. I was going to use that word. I had the great misfortune of having to be there to hear, as I heard the governor pontificate in glowing Christian terms about why allowing the federal government more control over the state was a biblical thing to do. Now, again, anytime John Kasich seems to be wanting to move something in a direction that would centralize power in his administration and take away legitimate authority from the other parts of state government, especially the legislature, he brings out the Bible, which is kind of a hallmark of many people doing that, trying to turn the Bible to say what they want it to say. You know, John Kasich said that if you oppose Medicaid expansion, then God's going to get you for that.
Well, I think maybe we should interview in short order, as quickly as we can, our friend down at American Vision, Dr. Joel McDermott, who has written a couple of books, one of which we use in our class, our Institute on the Constitution class, his book, Restoring America One County at a Time. But I think maybe a more important book that he's written on that subject is God versus Socialism.
Yes. I was just looking at that book the other day, and we probably will do that. And so for our listeners, if you want to get a jump on what we're going to talk to you about later on, you can go get a copy of that book from American Vision Press. It's called God versus Socialism. It's a really good read. It's short, too, so you'll be able to get into it and through it fairly quickly.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put that up on our Principled Policy bookstore.
Okay, great. So you can go to principledpolicy.com find it.
We have an Amazon bookstore, and you can get to that bookstore at our website, www.principledpolicy.com. And every time you buy a book, you help support the Institute for Principled Policy. Now, not to blow our horn too much, but we are a nonprofit, so we got to get some money in here to keep things running. And if there's a book you're looking for and you don't see it on our list, give us an email and let us know. We'll add it to the list.
Well,
and then you can buy
within reason.
Yeah, if it fits our topic list.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's not make that too carte blanche because you know what we're going to get.
Well, you know, but we have done. We have Dr. Mark Hamilton, who teaches classes at, he's a professor at Ashland University, and we have run his class reading list through our bookstore in the past.
Yes.
So we do things like that. It's really not that hard to do. I know how to do it. I'm not sure Barry knows how to do it, but he can figure it out pretty quick.
Maybe.
But I would suggest, if you want a handle on this, that you really pick up a copy of God versus Socialism. And it's a really good little treatise on how the church uses that tactic. They basically cherry pick the Bible. And McDermott goes through and sort of piecemeal, little bit by little bit, destroys the idea that you can actually call for socialism and tyranny using the Bible as your guide.
Well, and that seems to be where we're going to with this, because as you know, we called you to make calls to the Senate and House members who sat on the controlling board panel. Well, Chuck, Little did we know we were asking them to call some of the wrong people. Now, folks, that's not our fault. It's the fault of the legislative leadership who, in a 11th and a half hour move, substituted, took two members of that board off of the board and substituted two other members, one of whom gave John Kasich an extra vote to get his Medicaid expansion. And we're going to go into that here in just a second. But as you know, the Kasich administration asked for $2.5 billion over the next two fiscal years to expand Medicaid services to what they consider 138% of federal poverty level. Right now, the feds provide money, and the state puts in their own money to provide up to 100% of the federal poverty level supplemental Medicaid coverage for people for health needs. And again, sometimes helping the poor becomes a stop way to getting something else you want. And I think what John Kasich was wanting is votes for his reelection and votes potentially for a presidential run in 2016. He's basically trying to go out and make a case that he's looking out for people who normally are supposedly covered by Democrats, not by Republicans. The quote-unquote working poor, the destitute, the elderly, etc. Again, I think there's a much high politicization of this. And I think that the 11th and a half hour move by a legislative leader to make sure the votes were there is part and parcel of that politicization of the whole thing.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. That particular thing, attempting to steal votes from Democrats by adopting Democratic Party principles, has been a spectacular failure.
Yes.
In the past. If you'll recall the whole compassionate conservatism mess, yes, George W. Bush got elected twice, and he is now one of the most reviled presidents on the list. Now, the shortness of the time and the fact that he was followed up by such a really, truly awful president has sort of had people, I've seen bumper stickers and posters out there that say, "Do you miss me yet?" It says George W. Bush underneath. And my answer to that is, well, no, I don't miss you yet. Do I think you would have been better than this guy? No, I think we already know that you weren't better than this guy. It was different than this guy, but it's not any better. But that being said, we need to keep in mind that this strategy has failed and failed and failed and failed. Think about it in terms of immigration reform. The big deal was going to be in the 80s that illegal immigrants were going to get amnesty. We gave them amnesty, and they were all automatically supposed to be so grateful that they were all going to come over and vote for the Republican Party. How'd that work out?
Not so good. Not so good. I believe that the percentages are in the 80 percentile that don't vote in the for Republicans.
So. And again, we're not Republican-Democrat partisans, but if you're going to adopt a strategy based on the idea that it's going to bring you votes, there really should be a payoff at some point, and the fact is that there is no payoff. So I would posit that some of this is not really to get the votes. What it is to get is the program, and it's to get people who think in terms of that Republican-Democrat dichotomy to say, well, they had to do it to get votes. In other words, it's a sales strategy to get us to swallow the program and say, well, we had to do this, or that's the only way we could win elections.
Well, I think you make a good point there. But ladies and gentlemen, we do appreciate everyone who did make phone calls because ultimately the deck was stacked even more than we imagined when we recorded that program for last Saturday. Because what happened was, like I said, in the 11th hour, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, William Batchelder, made a substitution. He took the two Republican House members who were on the controlling board, Representative Ron Amstutz and Representative Cliff Rosenberger, who we found out were both going to be no votes on this expansion request, and replaced them with two other members, Representative Jeff McClain from Northwest Ohio, who also was a no vote. But the other person he replaced him with was Representative Ross McGregor from Springfield, who is definitely a yes vote for this expansion. McGregor is very much, his voting record shows that he's a very liberal member of the Republican caucus. He is the prime Republican sponsor on the gay rights expansion bills. He has voted for tax increases. He's very much both a fiscal and a social liberal. What that did was that gave the governor, who already had both Democrat House votes, or excuse me, the one Democrat House vote and the one Democrat Senate vote in his camp, he had the his chairman of the controlling board, who was working with the Office of Management and Budget, as a vote. And then he had, as we found out for sure after the vote on Monday, Senator Chris Widener from the Green County area. I think he doesn't cover Springfield and parts of Green and Clark counties and others. But Widener wouldn't tell anybody what his vote was, and of course probably already told the governor, so he knew he had the votes. But they wanted to make sure in case, no, because the rest of the body, including I think the House Speaker, didn't really know where he was specifically. And so they put on an extra yes vote in order to make sure the governor got what he wanted. Now, Chuck, it's egregious. You know, this is something that I will grant that technically the Speaker of the House of Representatives does have the power to appoint and depose whom he chooses on these boards and commissions that are staffed by legislators, such as the Joint Legislative Ethics Committee, the Joint Committee on Agency Rule Review, the Controlling Board, the Commissioners of the Sinking Fund. And I could go on and on because it's like pages and pages of special boards and commissions that legislators sit on, appointed by the leaders of their parties. And in this case, for the Republican Party, it's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, the minority leader, who is Chris Redfern, who was already on the controlling board, wouldn't have changed because he and the Senate cohort, Tom Sawyer, were both going to vote in favor of Medicaid expansion because, as Redfern was quoted directly in the news, this is the foundational corner piece to Obamacare. Medicaid expansion is the foundational corner piece to Obamacare being successfully locked in the state of Ohio. Now, this is interesting considering the fact that many of these Republican legislators have campaigned hard on ending Obamacare. Well, not Ross McGregor. So that's why they had their other yes vote.
Yep.
So, ladies and gentlemen, the vote was 5-2. The two no votes were Representative Jeff McClain and Senator Bill Coley from the Butler County area, from Westchester. Now, I want to applaud those two for basically standing up to the governor and saying, no, you know what, it isn't so much, and I don't think for either one of them, it's so much the issue of the money, it's the issue of who has the legitimate authority to do these things. You see, the controlling board is only supposed to be there to release monies that the legislature has already approved for expenditure. Now, the legislature, when they passed the budget in June, only gave the administration so much money to use for Medicaid to draw down from the federal level. It did not include this $2.5 billion expansion. As a matter of fact, they specifically spelled out under no circumstances would they allow the expansion of Medicaid through the budget. Now, the governor vetoed that language out of the budget, which we talked about last week, creates its own interesting constitutional crisis. But the other thing that happened is now we have a situation. Is there a legitimate function for the controlling board to go beyond both the intent and the actual appropriation of the state's lawmaking body in order to appease the chief executive of the state?
And that's part and parcel of where the constitutional crisis lies. Because under a constitutional separation of powers in our particular form of government, the legislature is supreme in doing things like allocating money. The governor can jump up and down and send recommendations and do all kinds of things to try to get his programs through the legislature, but the will of the legislature is supposed to be supreme. What this has done, from my perspective, is it has allowed the executive authority to seize power from the legislative branch that rightfully belongs in the legislative branch, and essentially entrench it in the executive branch. So what it's doing is essentially bypassing the the legislature. And the way he did it was by something that quote-unquote conservatives have been calling for decades, and that is with the line item veto.
Uh-huh, that's right. And that's exactly what he vetoed, this language, which was intent language by the General Assembly. Now, usually a line item veto is to veto the appropriations that the Assembly has chosen to give or not to give, or policy that they have chosen to write into Ohio statutes or to remove from Ohio statutes. That's where the governor can use a line item veto. The question of whether or not he can veto the intent of the legislature, Chuck, it speaks volumes to the hubris of our chief executive who thinks that he can just say, well, no, my will, not thine, be done.
Yeah,
O legislature.
O legislature.
To wax biblical.
Now, what I'm really disturbed about are the people who are acquiescing to this, and that are the people in the legislature. Those are the people in the legislature. For instance, under what circumstances is Bill Batchelder playing both sides of the fence here? And because I think there's a letter out floating around how there's going to be a lawsuit against
this.
Well,
there was a letter. It was signed by Speaker Batchelder and 38 other Republican members of the House challenging the governor and the controlling board's authority to basically do this end run around them. They're looking at the Constitution and saying, you don't have the authority to do this. Now, we have an audio clip here from the attorney who supposedly was working with these House members and who was interviewed right after the vote that the controlling board took on Monday when they voted 5-2 to say, we're going to expand Medicaid. Now, interesting thing, Chuck, the governor gets the budget at the end of June because it has to be in place by July 1, correct?
Yep.
In that budget, it was clear and unambiguous that the legislature was telling him, no, we're not going to allow the expansion of Medicaid. He vetoes that intent language. In August of this year, his administration, without the knowledge of the legislature, applied to the Federal Center for Medicaid and Medicare to expand Medicaid.
Yeah, implement the expansion.
Implement the expansion. And now this vote in October was after they got the green light from Kathleen Sebelius and Department of Health and Human Services. Then they went to get the money. Now, if that isn't a very shocking lack of constitutional awareness on our governor's part, then the only other thing it could be is absolute arrogance.
You're being kind, I think.
I'm trying to give a little benefit of doubt here, although very little.
You don't think John Kasich, who basically spent how many years in Congress? Like 24, I think?
I don't remember exactly what his numbers
were. Doesn't understand the Ohio Constitution well enough to know that you don't mix executive and legislative authority?
Well, yes, that's what I'm saying. That
you're being kind.
I'm being kind. Yes. And the possibility is that, well, the only other possibility is, Chuck, is that he just doesn't care.
Okay.
And honestly, I don't know. Maybe he had a number of quote-unquote legal scholars around him saying, oh, we see a loophole here, or the courts have ruled this way, or et cetera, so on and so forth, ad nauseum, ad infinitum. Maybe he believes that he is on solid constitutional ground in doing this, but the way he's approached it has created what is going to become a constitutional crisis, I believe, Chuck. And I think the audio that we need to play now from attorney Maurice Thompson lends to that idea.
One thing I'm going to say is you and I both warned,
yes,
before, when this man was running for governor, that this is what you're going to get.
Yes,
and
we did.
We had a lot of people who laughed at us and said, oh, no, he has a solid record as a quote-unquote conservative.
Yep.
Well, not, okay, we were
not
right.
Not so much.
Yeah, we were right, and those people were not correct.
Yep.
All right, here we go.
Go back and look at the notes we just talked about. What we heard here, it was nothing we didn't expect to hear today. So we've prepared a preliminary complaint, and barring anything unusual, we can file as soon as tomorrow.
Okay, you're filing the lawsuit. What are you contending?
The controlling board does not have the authority to act as a legislator. That's revised code 127.17. If it did have that authority, it would be unconstitutional. It would violate Ohio's Constitution, Article 2, which requires that general laws be made by the legislature. and that issue has been considered before by the Ohio Supreme Court, and the court's consistently come out on our side, and we would expect and hope that the court has the courage to do that again here on this much bigger case, albeit than some of the past ones.
So this is something that will be filed at the Ohio Supreme Court?
Most likely.
And don't you, they've ruled on this before, on the same, controlling board appropriating money. There have been other suits that have won through and back in many years, and they really haven't had much success with them. So
what the Ohio Supreme Court said very clearly in 1983 is that the controlling board is only constitutional at all because of revised code 127.17, which requires the controlling board to vote consistent with the acts of the General Assembly. The act of the General Assembly and the budget bill.
Okay, Chuck, I wanted to stop this just for a second because now we've taken one excuse out of the quiver. It was very clear that the courts, according to Mr. Thompson's analysis, have not said it's okay to do this. They've said you have to stay within the bounds of statute, which says, 127.17 of the Ohio Revised Code, the controlling board is a creature and they have to stay within the dictates of what the General Assembly has allowed. And where does the General Assembly speak when it comes to budgeting matters? The Ohio budget. And when they say you're only going to appropriate X number of dollars, the controlling board doesn't have the plenipotentiary power to go beyond them and appropriate more if it's offered, if the General Assembly has not allowed them to do so.
Yeah, just this will get into something we're going to talk about later. But this case, the controlling board is acting like a convention.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And ladies and gentlemen, this is foreshadowing for the second half of the program.
That's right.
Let's go back to Attorney Thompson.
Was very clear. It was a prohibition on Medicaid expansion and an appropriation of federal funds. Now, that act was line itemed by the governor. However, the governor's line item isn't relevant to the act of the General Assembly alone, which was to prohibit the receipt of these federal funds that today the controlling board accepted.
So you'll be suing on behalf of whom?
We'll disclose that tomorrow.
You expect that a House of lawmakers will be a part of the suit?
Most likely.
And you expect to file tomorrow?
Most likely.
What would prohibit you from doing that?
We're going to go home and review the notes here and make sure that nothing has changed. It did not sound to me over the last 2 hours like anything has changed. So I can't think of anything, but obviously there are a lot of unusual political overtones here that usually don't affect our cases, and those could be in play.
So if your suit proves to be successful, what do you say to the 366,000 Ohioans that won't be eligible for Medicaid?
Well, what this lawsuit would mean is nothing about whether those Ohioans would be eligible for Medicaid or some other kind of health care. Our litigation is strictly about the separation of powers and checks and balances in Ohio, and it's perfectly acceptable that the legislature could go back to the drawing board and work out something with the governor. In fact, our organization has been very vocal on Medicaid expansion as a policy issue itself, and we think that it's a bigger issue that the controlling board not have unlimited authority.
I wanted to stop there because
sure, please.
You and I listened to this off air, and my first question when I heard that question was, oh, I see, we're going to go the red herring angle. What does the fact that there are 366,000 people who may or may not be eligible for Medicare, frankly, I'm not eligible for Medicare, and I'm not looking to be eligible for Medicare. I assume I'm going to be continuing to pay for my own medical bills. What does that have to do with the price of tea in China? In other words, the fact that the governor has usurped authority that, strictly speaking, belongs to the legislature, and why doesn't the reporter who asked that question understand that?
Well, because they don't want to, Chuck. That's the whole point. This is all about the emotional appeal of, and this is the same thing Governor Kasich's been doing since his State of the State in February, and that is putting on the emotional baggage appeal of saying, oh, the poor, the crippled, the downtrodden, if we don't do everything we can for them, then we should be ashamed as a state.
Yeah.
But the point is that it's not the state's function legitimately to do these things. It's not the federal government's function legitimately, constitutionally, to do these things. It is the family and the church who are responsible for the care and well-being of the sick, the poor, the widows, and the orphans among us.
Yeah, and there is a phrase that's used very often about this particular philosophy that was espoused by this question, and that is the end justifies the means.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where does that come from? Well, it's not new philosophically, but it really plays out in sort of in Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, that was a Marxist question.
Yes.
What, it doesn't matter how you get there. What matters is
that you get there.
That you get there.
Okay. Well, Chuck, just to add another piece to that before we go back to the audio with Attorney Thompson, we're recording this on Tuesday, the day after this happened. In the Columbus Dispatch today is a little article by Jim Siegel. The Dispatch headlined, "Medicaid expansion leads to proposed tax cut." I knew you'd find that humorous. I haven't sent you the URL yet. I quote, "The $404 million that the state will save by expanding Medicaid." Okay, start laughing now, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, folks, all I can say is Obamacare was also going to save us money.
That's right. "Won't be around long if Senate Republicans successfully push a new permanent 4% state income tax cut." Chuck, I've heard of these permanent income tax cuts before that turn out to be very temporary, especially when they realize that those savings that they were banking on aren't there. Now, it's interesting because the bill was just introduced today. It doesn't even have a number yet. But guess who introduced the bill?
Oh, gosh.
Chuck, if you're thinking about it in terms of re-election strategy, it was the senator who voted yes on Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
Chris Widener from Springfield introduces the bill so he can run on both sides of the issue. Okay? Not only am I expanding government control and expense by going after federal money that we shouldn't be going after, I'm going to turn around and cut your taxes and be fiscally conservative.
Okay, but in the larger picture, this is exactly the way the game's being played, and we're going to expand on that later in the show. But this is the way this game is being played right now. It's going to cost you less over here. It's going to cost you more over here. So I'm going to play both sides and say, yes, it's going to cost you more, but it's going to cost you less.
Exactly. So that's to muddy the waters. Now, basically, supposedly, this is going to exhaust all the Medicaid expansion savings. Now, Chuck, I laugh at that because we know, I mean, think about the launch of the early registration period that started in October with the Obamacare website.
Yeah.
What savings is there when you've got a $400 million computer program that can't do more than 50,000 at a time?
Well, they've got a fix for that now. You can call in.
Oh, yeah, which I heard that the phones are busy or disconnected in some reason.
Well, let me ask you a question. If you call in, how do you actually look at the plan to know what the one is that
you go to the website, Jeff. Wait a minute.
Oops, it doesn't work.
Okay, so here's the deal. Widener is basically saying, I'm going to pass this. I introduced this bill today, and we hope it passes in the first week of November. So, in other words, this is fast track for the next 2 weeks so that they can run on it when they go into primary season starting in January. And supposedly, he says, quote, "This seems to be an appropriate way to start the conversation and add to the tax cut we started in the budget," unquote. No, an appropriate way to start this conversation was to say, "I'm a legislator, and I cannot vote in favor of the governor doing an end run around us. And if I'm going to be a fiscal conservative, I'm not going to go after federal money that's dangled in front of me," which, oh, by the way, and I think we talked about this in the last program, the federal government will have to extend the debt in order to fund.
Yes. And
in order to do their full Medicaid expansion to all 50 states, as they proposed, they're going to have to increase the debt, which is now at $16.7 trillion and growing, now that we've given them another trillion. So it's now 17.7 because the budget deal last week gave them an extra trillion, by $6.3 trillion, Charles. The money's not there. That money that Governor Kasich keeps saying it's our money. No, it's not, Governor Kasich. They don't have the money, and the only way they can get the money is by going out and selling more debt. Now, I'm sorry, but a temporary relief of a medical bill versus decades and decades of debt service payments that our children and our grandchildren are going to have to make if this country actually stays solvent through this is a Hobson's choice.
Let's put it this way. If you assume there are 150 million taxpayers,
okay,
which is pretty close on the federal level, those numbers, just $1 trillion, okay?
Right.
1 times 10 to the 12th.
Right.
Divided by 150 million is $6,666.67 a piece.
Okay. Well, you know, Chuck, I'm going to have to look through under my couch cushions and, you know, move my dressers out so I can find all that loose change that I've got laying
now,
around.
Now, multiply that by 23 to get up to the actual $23 trillion figure. That means each taxpayer owes $153,333.33.
Is that every taxpayer or every citizen?
Every taxpayer.
Now, let's multiply that by citizen, which you said about 150. So there's about 311 million people
yes,
in the country.
You'd have to divide by two in a fraction.
Well, divide by two. Just divide by just, and this is the average, and this is for every man, woman, and child in America.
$76,666.67.
Each.
Each.
That's to cover what our debt is and will be under this program and under our current administration. Now, folks, if you've got an extra $76,000 laying around, you know, you got an IRA that you're still working on, you've got some, you know, old antiques, maybe some old comic books or something, you can sell. You better go ahead and get them sold right now because we got to work this debt down. So pretty soon that bill's going to come due, Chuck. $76,000 a piece. That means for a family of five, you're looking at almost $400,000.
Well, here's the deal. You might be able to sell a kidney. The problem is finding a doctor who can do it under Obamacare in less than 3 years.
Oh, no. That's sad. That's sad, but you're right. Okay, so we've seen all this. Now, let's go back to finish up because Maurice Thompson, they're going to sue. Now, I've not seen anything today hitting the news wires that they filed this suit yet.
Right.
So they may not be filing it till later in the week. And we'll just have to do a follow-up on it after the dust settles when they originally filed.
I would guess that there may be some, what do they call when a friend of the court or a...
amicus briefs.
And there may be amicus briefs that they're lining up to file.
Could be very well.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so more with
the Medicaid expansion either happen or not happen in Ohio. So that's really where our focus is.
So are you going to be asking for a temporary injunction on the appropriations? You will be.
Sort of. There's a different name for what we're looking at, but that's sort of correct. As you all know, the decision has to be made by January 1st, 2014. So we're on a really short track here. We're basically on a 10-week track to decide this up or down. If it lingers on beyond then, the expansion obviously is going to happen.
How do you respond to the argument that because this was vetoed and didn't become law, that's not legislative intent?
Sure. The revised code 127.17 specifically says the controlling board act must act consistent with the intentions of the General Assembly. The General Assembly does not include the governor.
It has no
bearing on the intentions of the General Assembly. Obviously, it has a bearing on what the law is today. And usually, the law and the intentions of the General Assembly will be synonymous. So it's very.
What's being made here is that important distinction.
Yes.
The reporter is arguing, and I let's give her the benefit of the doubt. She sees where this is all going. She's saying the intent of the legislature is there because the governor vetoed it, so the intent of the legislature doesn't matter in this case.
Oh, but au contraire, mon frère.
Exactly. The intent of the legislature always counts. This is the problem with the line item veto.
It can be a significant problem, but, you know, the beautiful part about the way we do business in Ohio's government, every version of legislation is out there, from the introduced version
right. All
the way up to the final enacted version, which means if you want to figure out legislative intent and the governor vetoes it out of the final version, just look at the version that was sent to him.
Yep.
That'll give you the legislative intent. Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? That's what the court's going to be looking at.
Yep.
Very unusual to have this kind of a law, but it's necessary to have this kind of a law focused on the intention of the General Assembly in order to render the delegation of legislative authority to the controlling board constitutional at all. And that's what the Ohio Supreme Court has actually said.
Since it's not a temporary injunction, can you help us out and tell us what it is?
Yeah. Sure. It's a writ of mandamus and prohibition.
But would it just be about...
Okay, a writ of mandamus. That's a really important constitutional function that a lot of people don't know about. A writ of mandamus is a requirement that an official do his duty. It's a court order that says you will comply with this, period.
Yes.
And you will do your constitutionally mandated job.
That's right.
So a writ of mandamus in prohibition means
you
can't do what you're going to do.
That's right.
Accepting the money or... would it be about expansion more broadly?
One of the issues is the controlling board's actions today.
Yeah.
There is another legal issue that relates to something that you've heard about inside here, and it has to do with the state plan amendment that was proposed by the director of Medicaid,
so you're challenging
which is also a very recent development, and you'll kind of see how those two interplay about this time tomorrow.
So you would be challenging the whole thing then, as far as your written amendment?
Yes, we will not put in quotes when we file it. Yes.
Coming in late, if you could again just tell us your next step at this point.
We're looking at legal action related to the law authorizing the controlling board. Revised Code 127.17 requires the board to act consistent with the intentions of the General Assembly, and the General Assembly's budget bill explicitly prohibits the receipt of federal funding that today the controlling board receives for the expanded ACA Affordable Care Act population, which is up to 138% of poverty level.
And will we go into court tomorrow? Is that what?
We hope so.
So as we heard today, this decision will last through the biennium.
Right.
If you're successful, that decision will last past the biennium into the future.
This is an important question. Successful.
Let's hope so.
Yes, absolutely.
Because obviously the reporter that asked that question doesn't really understand the issue.
No.
Yes.
No, not at all.
This should be a permanent smackdown to the governor attempting to seize legislative authority through the use of the controlling board.
Yes.
And the use of the line item veto in conjunction with stacking the deck in the controlling board with the help of the Speaker of the House, which is really sad.
Yes.
But, okay.
For us, looks like the Ohio Supreme Court simply reminding the controlling board of its limited authority. It does nothing to prohibit the future expansion of Medicaid, the retraction of Medicaid, as you heard today, or any other kind of Medicaid policy. All we're indicating is that that kind of decision cannot be made by these seven people sitting at this chair today. As one of the members pointed out, in a very truncated hearing where really this should be done before, the General Assembly, very deliberately, with a number of witnesses and testimony, and what we saw was kind of a makeshift attempt at reproducing what the General Assembly can do so much better and representing all Ohioans instead of the very limited number of Ohioans who are represented in that room today. So this really is about administrative largesse and administrative overreach. And the Ohio Supreme Court does make it clear the controlling board is an administrative agency. It's not a super legislature.
Really important point.
Yes.
Most administrative agencies, who are they under the control of?
The executive branch.
The executive branch. So really, the controlling board is a legislatively appointed group with administrative capabilities under the executive branch. The legislature, it's about implementing the laws that the legislature have passed, but that's in the executive branch's bailiwick.
Yes, it is.
So it's a problem all around, I think.
Yes, it is.
So as we've heard before, the Ohio Supreme Court has made rulings for the legislature on school funding. And the legislature has basically said, thanks for the suggestion.
Right.
We're going to do what we want to do. Does this also apply to your court case? In other words, going forward, could they come back and do this at the start of the next biennium?
No prediction whatsoever as to what might happen in the legislature or even in the court for that matter. We think we have a strong legal argument, but no idea how the court will handle it.
And that's the end of that. That recording. Very interesting, and honestly, we've already heard that they essentially have a case. So this isn't some frivolous attempt to, the poor governor, they're going to take away his authority to do this and that and another thing. The whole point is, he doesn't have the authority.
That is it. And you know what, Chuck? You know, this is one of those things that I'm kind of glad this is happening, in one sense, because as people are waking up and they're actually learning that there is much to be understood by people who thought they understood things, whether it be in our culture or whether it be in our politics, because a lot of people just assume a lot of things. But what we're seeing now is, guys, we have written laws for a reason. We have frameworks for a reason. We have a constitution, both at the federal level and the state level, which limit powers, which delegate, which enumerate only the things that only those bodies can do. Those are very important, and if we don't understand them and we don't know them, then people with agendas, and I'm not naming any names here, Governor Kasich, will be able to basically get their way anytime they feel like, which is a definition of a tyrant.
Yes, a tyrant, and people who support tyranny view the legislature in cases like this not as the final authority on whether a law gets passed or not, but a stumbling block to the agenda of the executive authority. Once you hear people, when I've heard it on the news at the national level, that Congress is standing in the way of the president. Well, of course they are. That's their job.
That's right. That is it.
So this is kind of frustrating for someone like us who are sitting here and understanding it from the perspective that the legislature legislates, the executive branch implements, and he doesn't get to tell the legislature they're doing a bad idea except through the veto. And the line item veto, which is then used with an extra legal parliamentary procedure to then create something that was obviously outside the intent of the legislature.
Right.
Is tyranny writ large.
Yeah, it is. It is. But you know what, Chuck? Going into the other topic we're going to talk about today, maybe we don't have to worry about that anymore. because, ladies and gentlemen, we've talked about this topic before, but now we have a new target. It seems that the Ohio Senate, yes, again, our friends over in the Senate are having some issues with understanding plain text, as Chris Widener did when he voted in favor of this end run around the legislature. This one is on the Senate President, Keith Faber, who introduced just about 2.5 weeks ago Senate Joint Resolution Number 5. Now, SJR 5 is very familiar to you and I, Chuck, and it'll be familiar to our listeners because it's the same call for an Article 5 Constitutional Convention for the purpose of balancing the federal budget. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, they're back at it again. The House version ran into a little stymie when they couldn't count noses and get up to a majority on the committee in order to pass the bill. But now in the Senate, I think they've fixed that problem because Senator Faber introduced this bill with 17 other Republican Senate co-sponsors. So that's 18 people. It only takes 17 votes on the Senate floor in order to pass legislation, Chuck. So he thinks by the number of co-sponsors he has that they'll all vote in lockstep and they'll pass it from the Senate floor. Well, first they have to go through committee. Well, not to worry. The Senate president's got that one fixed too. They sent it to the Senate Finance Committee. The 9 Republican members out of, I believe there's 13. Yes, there are 13 members of the Senate Finance Committee. 9 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Okay? It only takes 7 votes to get out of Finance Committee. Okay? Because it's a simple majority. Of the 9 Republican members on the committee, 8 of them are co-sponsors on this piece of legislation.
So
he's pretty sure he's got the votes there too, Charles. Now, last week, you're going to be hearing this on Saturday, so 2 weeks ago, Tuesday, there was the first hearing on this resolution and where Senate President Faber stood in front of the committee and told the reasons why we need to pass this resolution and put Ohio on the map as calling for an Article 5 convention. Now, we have that audio now, don't we, Charles?
We do.
And we want to play that for you, and then Chuck and I will break it down and analyze it. This past Tuesday, proponents of the measure, which includes groups from South Dakota and Florida and I think Texas, came in to give their reasons why it's a wonderful idea to do this. We are hoping that after you hear this, the following Tuesday, we get the chance to
talk. That's right.
We're looking forward to that, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be talking a little bit about it, not in great detail on this program, but especially Chuck has been doing a yeoman's job of research, and we do believe we've found a few things that might make this issue, shall we say, radioactive?
Yeah, a little bit. Hopefully, if people get a look at the historical data that we're dealing with, and that's one of the things I want to talk about. You know, we talked about Mark Levin's book, and at the time we did the interview with Levin, we had not read the book, and we have both since picked it up and read about as much of it as is necessary to. I've been through the book lightly. I especially paid attention to the first chapter. And the fact is, one thing I noticed that was conspicuously absent was any references to primary materials.
Well, no, I don't think there's any until you get toward the end. But all that's doing is where he discusses his amendments, and he references back to the Constitution and to the Federalist Papers.
The only person that Levin really quotes is someone who is a partisan advocate for a new constitutional convention, and that is Robert Nadelson of the Goldwater Institute. He is a paid consultant, a retired law professor from the Goldwater Institute. And the fact is that I have read a lot of Nadelson's writings, and I did follow his primary documentation around, and I dug up my own primary documentation. And let's just say that Nadelson is drawing conclusions from his reading of the materials that can't be drawn from it.
Oh, of course not. No. Well, that's called cherry picking.
Yes, it is.
And we try not to engage in that here at the Institute for Principled Policy, but we can't speak for any other think tanks who are trying to either, I guess, get a piece of policy moved or to find ways of getting funding for their policy agendas.
Well, there's nothing wrong with trying to get your policy moved and writing papers in favor of it. What's really wrong is twisting history in order to make it look like it says something it doesn't say. If you want to hold a constitutional convention, then make a good argument for it, but don't come out and say that things can be done which can't be done, and things can't be done which can be done. The fact is that there is a very poor understanding of how conventions work and what they are, and when we bring those up, we're called paranoid, and this is a sign to me, Barry, when the first thing that happens is we start getting tarred with these broad brushes about paranoia and groups we work with. And I said, oh, you know what that means? And Barry always says, yeah, that means they can't answer our questions.
They can't answer our questions. That's right.
Because that's usually what happens. The name calling comes out. So I think we'll listen to what President of the Senate Faber has to say, and then we will break in when necessary.
Yes.
To the U.S. Constitution for quite some time. This week, he introduced a resolution in the Senate calling for the formation of a constitutional convention to pass a balanced budget amendment.
This resolution is targeting that issue and that issue alone. It first asks Congress to balance.
Okay.
You're going to break it. I knew it wasn't going to take long.
What he's talking about there is the fact that the convention is being called to work on a single thing.
No, it's not.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a convention called to work on a single thing. Now, people will point to, for instance, things like the Annapolis Convention or the Mount Vernon Conference the Conference Convention of 1861.
Right.
Here's the problem. None of those, not a single one, was an Article 5 convention.
No.
Now, Article 5 didn't exist for the first two.
For the first two, that's right. And it's certainly, and the 1861 Conference Convention had no resemblance to an Article 5 convention.
All those so-called conventions were conferences of state delegates, and they were there to work on single issues.
It was sort of like a meeting of the National Conference of State Legislatures or the National Governors Association. They're not actually creating policies that the state has to do. They're just putting together their wish list for what they would like the states to do.
Here's the problem. For instance, the Mount Vernon Conference was illegal.
Yes, it was.
And,
yes, it was.
And the Annapolis Convention was, shall we say, extra legal?
Yes, I think you could be fair and say that.
Because they were attempting to create trade agreements between states that were forbidden by the highest law in the land, which was the Articles of Confederation.
That's right, because that was the existing constitution, federal constitution of government, as some of the state petitions called it.
So Faber's trying to make the point, well, we're only calling this for one thing. Guess what?
He doesn't have that power to do.
The Philadelphia Convention that brought us the Constitution was essentially called for one, for the sole and express purpose of creating trade a better trade picture and fixing some nebulous other problems.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that once you call a convention, it is a fully armed and loaded plenipotentiary device. Now, what that means is it has all power to change the way government works.
Right.
We have had four conventions in Anglo-American history. Every single one of them has resulted in a change of the form of government.
That's
a fundamental
right.
change.
That's
not
right.
a little minor change, a fundamental change.
Two of them in England prior and two of them
in the,
United States.
And a lot of people don't know that the Continental Congress acted as a convention in creating the Articles of
Confederation. It was a confederation. They had to.
Yeah,
they had to.
It
was the only way they could.
Yes, that's the only way they could do it was by acting as a convention. Okay, let's go back to it.
Balance its budget and calls for Congress to pass a constitutional amendment requiring them to balance the budget except in times of emergency.
And bingo.
There we have it. The times of emergency clause, the loophole that consumes all other loopholes,
That's
I would
it.
Say, Chuck. Because, ladies and gentlemen, anytime we basically live in a state of emergency in this country, we are actually at war with other countries. Well, we're on a war on terrorism, which is a never-ending emergency, Chuck.
Yes.
Because a war on terror, well, how do you eradicate terror?
Yeah.
You don't. Which means that if you're constantly at war with something you can't eradicate, you're constantly in a state of
emergency. There was actually a legal state of emergency declared in 1972, I think,
mm-hmm.
and it has been renewed by every president since. So we've been in a state of emergency since 1972. There was a state of emergency that lasted all through the 40s. So when is it that a balanced budget is required? Well, never. This is a meaningless. So we're basically opening the gate to a major league gamble with our form of government, because this idea of calling a constitutional amendment to balance the budget is simply it's a vehicle. The same way that the calling of the Philadelphia Convention was to get an interstate commerce agreement. That was really the purpose. Everybody understood it that way, and to fix some other problems that they didn't want to deal with, they couldn't deal with in Congress. Nobody knew. Or very few people. I shouldn't say nobody. There were people that knew. But it was kind of kept a very deep, dark secret that there were people in there whose job was to completely change the form of government. How are we going to stop that?
Well, we're not going to stop it now. We can't even stop a governor from running around the legislature to expand Medicaid.
And that was the point I made when I said that the controlling board is acting as a convention. It's making law when it's not empowered to do that.
That's exactly right.
So it's
not technically in a legal sense acting as a convention, but effectively acting as one.
Yes, exactly. It is an extra, again, it's an extra legal convention, although this is too complex. We won't go into that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the point is if it's actually called as a convention, there is no legal binding on it at that point.
That's it. It deals with unwritten law.
Now, folks, when we say convention, we're not talking about a convention like the Shriners Convention
right.
or the convention for your company's, parent organization where they fly you out somewhere, wine you and dine you, give you a lot of motivational speakers, and then send you home. We're talking about a convention to change or to amend your structures of government.
And it has to be called by the representatives of the body politic.
That is true, and we'll get to that later too.
Yeah.
But maybe not on this program.
Not today. We won't, because we got about 5 minutes.
We'll
left.
Be talking more about this as we go to testify next
yes.
week.
It takes 34 states to call for a convention, 38 to ratify an amendment. Right now, approximately 20 other states have resolutions pending.
Well, okay. Now, Chuck. They're making a key assumption
yes.
that we will show historically was proven wrong once.
Yes, that's
okay?
right.
Okay, they're assuming that ratification of anything that might this new convention might put together will take place exactly the way the Constitution currently says ratification needs to take place. In other words, the whole idea of 75% of the states or 38 states ratifying it, and that. Chuck, was a new invention of the document that replaced the Articles of Confederation whose ratifying procedure was unanimous consent of all 13 states.
Yep.
Now, it's interesting because we've done some research, but we're not going to give it away, but there is some historical literature, I will say, that gives a that shows you clearly that if you do not learn from history, you are going to be doomed to repeat it.
That's right.
And that's what we hope to show our senators in the Finance Committee and Senate President Faber when the Institute for Principal Policy testifies on this, most likely next week, because they're trying to push this thing out before November so that the House can then send it to a committee that they actually have votes in, which I'm not sure if there is a committee of the House that they can send it to that we may not be able to stop it. It would be very, very questionable how many of those. Of course, we're going to prep it by sending our materials over there ahead of time.
Oh, absolutely. There's no point in that. And I've been writing furiously for the last few days trying to get the stuff prepared. But the research that we've been able to do here at the Institute for Principal Policy has really just found some blockbuster stuff in what is really kind of a mundane review of the standing literature. Now, the question is, why didn't the great researchers over at Goldwater Institute or the American Legislative Exchange Council find this stuff?
Because they didn't want to, Charles.
Oh, they found it.
They buried it.
They buried
they
it.
They buried it.
They did. They buried this stuff. I mean, it's readily available. Most of the documents that I used are I'm using an internet reference.
Yeah.
Because finding it printed in a book, I did find the book. It was about $80. So I said, well, I'll take the online version. Although I like to have those kind of books in my collection because they can't disappear.
Yep.
Well, they can, but they generally don't. We're basically finding out that the scholarship, I don't like to make this claim up front, the quote-unquote scholarship is flawed, if not disingenuous.
I was going to say you're being kind.
Now I'm being kind.
Now you're being kind.
No, it's disingenuous. It's there are ways to interpret data, you know, one way or another. And I'll be the first to admit that historical documents can be ambiguous, especially if you don't understand the context in which they're written.
Right.
And part of the research that I've done is an attempt to show the context, not add context, but bring in the context of what's written so that people can understand what the meanings of some of the phrases are. And that is being conspicuously avoided basically lied about. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. When people say,
let's use a literary reference. They're trying to push it down the memory hole.
They're trying to push it in the memory hole. That's right. George Orwell,
1984. That's right.
What is happening, for instance, is people that say, when you see the phrase federal constitution in some of the calling, they're actually calling for a new constitution. That's absurd on its face. What they were talking about was the Articles of Confederation, which was the federal constitution.
Yes, it was.
And the statement is actually made by one of these scholars that there's no evidence that that's true. And I picked up a book on the writings of James Madison.
Yes.
I got partway in. I did a search.
Sure.
On volume one out of four volumes. When I got to the count of 50 places where James Madison specifically referred to the Articles of Confederation as the Federal Constitution, I stopped counting because it was pointless after that. I read the documents, the secret proceedings of the Continental Congress from the Articles of Confederation period, and I found numerous places where the Articles of Confederation was referred to as the Federal Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, was that a general way of thinking about the Articles of Confederation? The answer is yes.
Well, absolutely, yes. Confederation was because each of the colonies believed that they were sovereign and independent, and they were sharing certain functions together.
Yes. They had federated.
Yes, they had federated. Now they have constituted a single union. So instead of these United States are, it's now these United States is.
The United States is. But that's really only since the war between the states.
Yes, it is.
It's because that particular viewpoint of the the compact theory was thrown out once and for all, basically, although there are those of us out here who keep resurrecting it. That being said, okay, you got a taste of it. Keep your ears peeled because we're going to be reporting on this further, and we would ask you to join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.